Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Brown Skin Speaks Radio. I am your host for this evening, Thursday, February 24th, and I go by the name Brown Skin. Tonight's episode shines light on misperceptions, judgments, and stigmas associated with sexually transmitted disease, but coming from the female perspective. My first guest contracted the HIV virus back in 1988, through commercial sex work and intravenous drug use. Now she works as a community educator for Access AIDS Care in the Hampton Roads area of Virginia. Here to share her story and shine light on this rapidly spreading disease in the Black community, I welcome Ruth Royster. Good evening, Ruth. How are you?
I'm fine, and thank you for having me.
No, thank you for being a guest. I'm humbled. Our second guest will be joining us shortly, and I'll introduce her as she comes on. But, again, thank you so much, Ruth. You know, I really appreciated you and Irma and Access AIDS Care. But, you know, a lot of misperceptions and stigmas comes with the virus HIV and AIDS. How did you contract HIV?
I had a 20-year history, past history of intravenous drug use. And so during my years of addiction, there were, you know, I had many risky behaviors, so I did many things that put myself at risk for the HIV virus.
Right. Now, I know briefly I had mentioned you also were, you said, a commercial sex worker. For those that may not know what that is, like, what is that and how did you get into that? Like, what brought you to doing that?
Well, I started selling my body for drugs. You know, I didn't start off like that. But as I got addicted to drugs, it was always, it just kept getting deeper and deeper in the not yet, in the not yet. But I started off snorting cocaine, smoking marijuana. It increased to the point of me injecting drugs, and then even in the last few years of my addiction, became a crack addict, smoking crack, and that didn't come out till many years later. And so during those years when I didn't have money for my drugs, you know, I would prostitute. I would go on the street and sell my body.
Yeah. How old were you when you started doing this?
Maybe 17.
Okay. Now, do you think, you know, what was your childhood like growing up and then all of a sudden doing drugs and just this whirlwind of various dangerous activities happening in your life? Did that contribute at all to anything that you got into when you were younger?
When I look back on it now, I think a lot of it was peer pressure. No one in my family was drug addicts. I grew up in Harlem in the Bronx in New York, I was born here in Virginia.
Okay.
So, yeah, but I grew up in New York because New York is my dad's home. So myself and my oldest brother lived there. We got introduced to drugs because it was plentiful. It was always around. You know, we lived in the inner city, and it just was a lot of drugs during that time. In the 60s and the 70s, there was a lot of drugs, and we live in an infested drug neighborhood. And I just think that it was a lot of peer pressure. I just wasn't really sure of who I was. You know, just trying different things.
Yeah. So this basically took place in New York. I currently live in New York now, but I, you know, just reading back, even around that time, I know New York was really big, even Harlem, like you said, with drugs and different things of that nature. how much did you know about HIV AIDS, you know, back in 1988, like before you even contracted it?
Well, this is the strangest thing, and I talk about this story a lot.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, it was in the 80s, my drug addiction had became full force. I was definitely in the grips of my addiction. The funny thing, they started talking about AIDS and it was all over the television, and I was living in Harlem, New York at that time, so it was always on television, and they were showing gay men that were dying. They weren't talking to people that were living, or they were even talking about living with HIV or AIDS. It was all about dying, and they were just saying it was a gay male disease. And I remember, like, the corners that I hung on at that time and where I hung out at, there were people that we would go up on the block and we would be hanging out. It was like, where is so-and-so? And they said, oh, they died last night. They died with AIDS. And then be the end of our conversation, and we would all just walk away, go somewhere, and start getting high together again, sharing needles again. And, when I look back on it, that was a really strange time because it was in the grip of the epidemic. The epidemic was there, and it was like we were almost afraid to talk about it. We never discussed it. So that was really funny, you know. It was really weird now that I look back on that.
That's funny that you said that because even now, that was, you know, you said in the 80s, but we're in 2011, and it's still taboo to even discuss living with an STD, contracting STD. I'm kind of baffled myself on why we aren't able to talk about it amongst ourselves. When you all didn't talk about it, was it because you all didn't want to admit to that reality or face that reality that this was actually happening and right next door and killing people?
I mean, it was actually like in our circle, like in the circle of friends that, you know, acquaintances, now I know better, but that I hung out with. So it was maybe like six or seven of us that got together every day, hustled every day, shout out by drugs together every day. So one among us was like dying, and we just did not talk about it. And then after they died, you know, we'd just be sad. I don't remember going to anybody's funeral. I remember a couple of times going up to Harlem Hospital during this time and, seeing somebody that had gotten so skinny that they were just skeleton. They had no meat on their bones, so not even recognizing them once I got there. And then they would just say, you know, I'm dying, you know. And we come away and we, you know, be sad about it. It was like we lost somebody else, you know, to this, to AIDS. We were just talking about AIDS. We weren't even calling it HIV at the time. So I think it was, and I think one of the things for me, I think it was a very frightening time because everywhere you looked, every time you turned the television on the radio, it was just talking about this disease that came out and people were just dying. So you were just expecting to drop dead. But the thing about it is none of us was really educated about it. Yeah, and, you know, and being in my addiction at that time, I never stopped to think or educate myself. And it was like you was given your diagnosis and you was given a death sentence along with your diagnosis because I personally was given a death sentence when I got my diagnosis.
What was your initial response when you found out you had it?
Well, I was 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I was 30 years old. I'm now 52. I'll be 53 this year.
Oh,
and so, yeah, Yeah. So, I just truly thank God. I don't use drugs anymore. I've been clean and sober almost 20 years now. So, yeah, God is good, and it's truly a blessing. But at that time, I just thought I was dying. So I had went to a drug facility to clean up. I was actually in a rehab because I was going back and forth to jail, and I had a drug charge. And so while I was in this facility, somebody came in. They was doing this whole spill about HIV and AIDS, and they said, the risk factors are intravenous drug users, multiple sex partners. And I'm like, okay, all right, I know, these are things I do. So let me get tested. So I was in this facility for 30 days, and they came in. They didn't have the rapid testing. So they came in, they tested me, they did my blood work, and they came back in a couple of weeks. And they gave the results out, and they called everybody in and called me in last. And I don't know if anybody else got a positive diagnosis in there, but I know that they called me last. And when I think about it, I think that's why they called me in last. And they told me that I was HIV positive. I would probably live about 2 more years, don't have any more unprotected sex, and gave me 2 condoms. I was like, whoa.
Wow.
That's what I said. I was like, wow, okay. So I really done it this time, And all I could think of was all of the people that I knew were dying and all of the media showing death everywhere. So I left the facility and I went back on the street and I continued to get high because I was just waiting to die.
Oh my goodness. We're gonna get more into that. My second guest, she's actually joining us now. She's a close friend of mine. At the age of 16, she contracted herpes from her partner. Today she's 17. Contracting this virus at a young age changed her views on a lot of things and obviously how her friends live theirs. Also here to share her story, I welcome Jennifer. Jennifer, are you there? Can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi, Jennifer. So Ruth is on the phone, Jennifer. Ruth Royster, she has HIV virus, and I brought both of you ladies on board to share the female perspective on living with, living and dating with an STD and kind of your story so people can, know that this is real and that this can happen to them. Jennifer, real quick with you, you're currently living with herpes, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you know which, obviously there's two, which one are you living with? Are you living with oral or is it genital?
It's genital.
It's genital herpes, okay. Now, how old were you? You were 16 when you contracted it, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So now you're 17. Did you just turn 17 or are you about to turn 18?
I'm about to turn 18.
Okay. What was that like for you at 16 contracting this virus from someone that you obviously trusted, that you were dating?
Well, I was scared. Like, I didn't understand. I had educated myself before, but I was just being careless. And I don't know, I kind of felt like I was just done. Like, that was it for me. I couldn't be with anybody else. I didn't have the balls to be with anybody else. Like, I just, I didn't really know what to think.
Right. And that was the biggest thing I thought about with you at your age. We're living in a society where people will judge you just by your nail color, your nail polish being chipped on your fingernails, let alone, you being a teenager in high school. Do any of your friends or peers know that you're living with it?
My closest friends, 2 of my closest friends do, but that's it.
Yeah. And what were their thoughts and views on it?
They both cried and hugged me and told me that I wasn't any different to them, and they pretty much accepted me for what I was.
Right. But how did that make you feel?
I don't, emotion isn't something that I just, let go all the time. So I wasn't crying. I was, being stern and kind of more worried about them not being in my situation. But it made me feel good that they accepted me, because those are the people I surround myself with.
Right, right. Are you dating now?
No, I'm not.
Okay, and that's obviously by your choice.
Yes.
Okay, okay. Now, if you're just now tuning in, you're listening to Living and Dating with an STD, Female Perspective, on Brown Skin Speaks Radio. I have Ruth on air, and I also have Jennifer, and they're both living with HIV and herpes, respectively, and they're here to share their story. Feel free to call in with any questions at 347-202-0591. Now, Jennifer, real quick, back to you. You said you educated yourself a little bit about herpes. I mean, how much did you know about herpes before you contracted it? Because, you know, you know how you hear about STDs all the time, and you're like, oh, that would never happen to me. Oh, look at that medication on the commercials. But what did you know before then, you know?
Well, it was really like little middle school courses that you take, like the sex ed classes, and they pretty much tell us the top part, that you can get it with, you know, by having unprotected sex with somebody, and they basically told us, like, what it's like, what it feels like, showed us what it looked like, and that's pretty much all it was. They didn't really get into deep detail. They just, you know, showed us the pictures and said that it's something that you live with forever.
Interesting. Do you believe that?
Do I believe? I mean, I do, but I just feel like there's different ways to go about it.
Right. Now, how do you address the unprotected sex elephant in the room situation with your friends? Like when you hear about them just being reckless, how do you approach them or talk to them about this?
I tell them that it's reckless. Like, I don't come at them like, oh, I'm so angry with you, because they don't hear me. But I tell them, like, it's not safe. We live in the DMV area. Like, it's too easy to, like, run into things like this. I was like, it's 2 seconds out of your, you know, whatever you're about to do, just be like, can you please put a condom on? If he's not willing to do that, he doesn't really deserve your body.
And my friend, where is the DMV area for those that may not know?
Oh, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia.
Yeah, okay. Now, this question is to both of you all, just, you know, Jennifer, as you were saying. What type of supplemental medication are you taking right now?
It's a pill. It's like Valtrex. I guess when you're having a breakout, you take it. If not, you don't have to. If you're in a relationship, you should take it while you and your partner are being active, although you should still use protection.
Okay. And Ruth, what about you? I know there's a lot of, you know, misperceptions or even just ignorant assumptions about the medication that you take. Like, how many types of medications do you take, and how often do you have to take them?
Well, you know what? We're very fortunate in this country, and I say in this country because we're different than a lot of the third world countries, that I take one pill a day. It's a combination of three HIV medications, but they're in one pill, one tablet. So the researchers in this country have done a really, really good job at condensing the pill burden on HIVers.
Right.
Yeah, so, I my regimen is pretty good. The other things I take have nothing to do with HIV. It's just stuff, the aging, you know, high blood pressure, cholesterol medicine.
Right.
Because I don't eat health like shit.
Well, yeah, that was my next question to you. I was going to ask you, you know, what's your diet like now? Are you mindful of what you eat, you know, taking all these types of, you know, medications or different things?
Well, like I said, I don't take a lot of medication for HIV. I take one tablet at night. I should be more mindful of what I eat. I'll have weeks when I try to eat really healthy. But I don't, and, you know, I just got to be really honest about it. You know, I eat a whole lot of starches. I eat some fried food. I eat some stuff that I probably that's not healthy for me. So, you know, I could really do better in that area and really I could do a lot better
than
I am. But,
now, Jennifer, what about you? You know, I mean, I know this is all new to you. You know, this happened, about a year ago, almost 2 years ago. What do you do? Are you kind of just going along with emotions? How's your diet?
My diet, I don't really have a diet. I'm in high school, so I eat whatever's available. If it's there, I'm going to eat it. But I keep the stress level low. If I feel like it's going to cause me high stress, I just back away from it. Because I know that my body will react in a terrible way to that.
Yeah.
That's really important, and it's really smart of you to be a young woman to have identified stress as being a factor in, you know, your disease, because it is. It's the same thing with HIV. It's like stress can really make you sick. And so we have to really be, you know, cautious of, you know, carrying a lot of stress. And so I try to eliminate as much as possible in my life.
I want to share a couple of facts that I found or read on the Center for Disease Control on both HIV and AIDS, and I mean HIV and herpes, but, you know, starting with you, Ruth, if you can even verify this or tell me an update, but it said at the end of 2007, blacks accounted for 46% of people diagnosed with an HIV infection in 37 states. And 5 U.S.-dependent, long-term, confidential, name-based areas. I'm assuming they probably have, but have those numbers increased?
The same statistics. And I'm not really, really good with statistics. I don't quote a lot of statistics because I believe in that they can be, true depending on who and what the statistics are for, but the CDC, which is for disease control, they pretty much, you know, are accurate as much as possible. But we do recognize that most of the HIV cases now are among blacks.
Right.
And a lot of the cases are actually among heterosexuals, heterosexual couples, you know, male and female, where the male has infected the female. And those numbers, have increased over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Do you know, and I'm glad you made the point about the statistics because, you know, the next statistic I'm actually going to read it says about herpes, it's a nationwide 16.2% of women, which is one in every 6 women aged 14 to 49 have genital herpes or HSV2. But it also says that 48% of black women ages 14 to 49 are living with this virus. So sometimes you start to question, like, are the statistics accurate? You know, who are they showing this? You know, it's easy to believe these things and these numbers, but then the other question is how much of this is true, you know, and for what purpose, and all these other things. I don't know, Jennifer, did you know any of those statistics when it came to black women being more than half of black women living with this virus?
I didn't.
Now, you know, Ruth, Jennifer, back to you. I wanted to know, you know, the guy that gave you the virus, what was his reaction when you told him?
Oh, of course he denied it. He had nothing to do with it. I laid down by myself. I did this by myself. I was imagining things. He even pulled the one that he had just went to get his yearly checkup and all that. But just the day before, I got out of the hospital and was like, yeah, you was messing around doing something else. I was just like, okay. I didn't even entertain the idea of it. I was just like, I'll deal with this on my own. You lying, whatever, that's your issue. And I just left it alone.
Yeah, and I'm assuming you all probably haven't talked since.
Oh, never. No.
Oh man, Ruth, wow. For you're an HIV AIDS educator with Access AIDS Care in Hampton Roads, Virginia. You know, how important was it for you to share your story with others?
I share my story because I don't want people to learn, first of all, that you can't look at a person and tell their HIV status. And then sort of, you know, what Jennifer was saying, to help other people, you know, say that this can happen to anybody. Because unless I share my diagnosis with you now, because I'm definitely not that person that I was 20-something years ago, Right. I don't do those things anymore. I don't run in those circles. So to look at me today, unless I tell you, you don't know. And, you know, I just want people to be educated about it because I think early on we didn't do a really good job at educating. That's where all of these stigmas came from, all of these assumptions. We assume that if somebody had HIV and AIDS, they were going to be really, really skinny, all broke out, and then they were going to die. And that is definitely not the face of HIV and AIDS. I'm one of the older people that have lived with HIV for a long time. I've lived with it now for 23 years. And so I was thinking before this interview, when is the last time, and I can't regulate in my mind, that I met a woman that actually knew she was diagnosed because of her being an intravenous drug user and the behaviors that she practiced, you know, trying to get her drugs. All of the women that come into my life now that are newly diagnosed, they are getting this virus through heterosexual contact. So that is the reality now. We have came full circle, and this is a whole different generation that is contracting HIV and AIDS now. And, you know, I applaud you. I thank you for having this interview because it's just not talked about enough. You know, like I said, back then, you know, everybody, the country was devastated and scared to death, and they kept talking about people dying. But that's 20-something years ago. You know,
right.
30 years now, we want to go back to the first reported case in 1981 in the United States. So now where's the information? You know, where is the information that's being passed out to young ladies and young men, you know, like Jennifer, who's giving them the facts? And she said earlier when she came on was that in school they just barely touch on it. And you're in the D.C. area,
yeah.
Am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm here in Virginia, in the Bible Belt, where I don't even think they teach on STDs in the school system.
Hmm.
You know, so depending on where you live at in the country, you may not even get any STD education in the schools. But we know that our youth are sexually active.
But the funny thing is they're more sexually active than ever. I wonder if schools feel that if they talk about this with people's children, that they may be, you know, it might be considered a liability, you know, they contract something, all of a sudden the child could say, well, I learned it in school. I learned it from my teacher. And I think that if we can let go of that, because I realize with teenagers, and Jennifer, you could chime in, if someone talks to you as an adult and informs you of something that you don't know, you're more likely to say, you know what, I remember hearing about this, you know, someone talked to me about this, opposed to I'm just going to find out on my own and then reach the consequences later. I feel like you would want to know these things up front so you can make better, more decisions.
Here's the thing, though. Like, when we were in middle school, because that's when I started taking these classes, like a part of, like, child education and all that,
yeah.
They give you a form, a consent form. Your parents have to sign for it. So the teachers, they only give you the top of it because it's up to the adults in your life every day that you live around that are raising you to follow up. They need to, like, mm-hmm. let you know what they really want you to know. They give us an idea, you know. They give us the thought of it, you know, like to think about it, to look into it yourself. But parents have to sign the sheet saying you can take the class. So I feel like it's up to the adults in your life to follow up with it also.
Okay. But I'm wondering, you know, back to what we were just saying about this not being talked about enough in schools. You know, you could probably count on your hand how many schools probably do sex education. And sex education beyond, here's the condom,
put it on like this, and this is what happened. You know what I mean? Because I remember my sex ed class, which eons ago, and it was in a private school, and I don't remember ever them talk. I don't remember them talking about STDs. I just remember them talking about condoms and being on your menstrual cycle as a woman. Like, that's all I remember. But I don't remember them talking about STDs. So what's saddening and disheartening is going out in this world and you getting hit with all these different things. Mm-hmm. Because a big thing, though, a lot of men are filing carriers for a lot of these viruses. And it was also saying, you know, on CDC website, and Jennifer, you could say this too, you know, men are most likely to transmit these viruses to women opposed to vice versa, because women, for some reason, are the way our bodies are made biologically, we're more susceptible to these diseases. You know, I just, it's amazing to me. It's just amazing to me. Jennifer, I mean, Ruth.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly correct. It's, you know, we're receivers. We're receivers.
Right.
And they're depositors, you know. And so they do. They transmit HIV eight to ten times greater than females transmit it to male partners.
Right.
Now, that is definitely a fact.
No, and, you know, I mean, going back to what you mentioned earlier, Ruth, you know, you know, contracting the virus, being 30, and now figuring out what's going to happen next. What did you have to deal with as far as the stigmas and the judgments when you started telling people, or people started finding out that you had this? Like, what was that like? What were some of the judgments and stigmas that you dealt with around that time?
Oh, well, you know, I gotta say that in my life, I've been very, very fortunate. I didn't deal with my diagnosis during the time I was in New York because I was still in my addiction, in my drug addiction.
Okay.
But I left a couple of years after my diagnosis. I left New York and came to the Hampton Roads area, which where I was born, so it's my home, and my parents was here. They had moved back here, so I did some detox, got myself together, and then I started educating myself about HIV, and during that process, I found a different circle of people. I found, you know, the access. I found the educators. I found people that was embracing, that was welcoming me. But still, you know, I have came up against stigma, but I informed myself, I empowered myself, and I got to a place in my life because I had been down that road of being discriminated. I had been discriminated for so long because of my drug addiction that really wasn't an issue for me. I could wipe that off, and I could move past that if I saw that someone didn't like me because of my diagnosis and they didn't even know me. So I took it upon myself to just try to get as much knowledge as possible and share that knowledge everywhere I went. And my family, they didn't shun me, and I got involved with a lot of good people in the HIV community that took the time to educate me and took the time to, and so with that, and I think that is what's helped me to sustain, you know, life beyond my diagnosis and be able to give back as much as I do, because at the time of my diagnosis and the people that were placed in my life, they really helped me a lot, and they still do. So, you know, I just had some really good people in my life.
So it wasn't, you know,
I didn't have that experience. I know a lot of people that do have that experience.
Right,
you know,
right.
I know a lot of people that tell me they can't even go to their family's house and, you know, eat on a piece of china. They still getting paper plates and, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm very involved in the church. And so I know people that, a lot of people say they don't go to church because when somebody finds out their HIV diagnosis, they're discriminated against. So, you know, personally, I've not had those. But I know that there are people that have, you know, talked about me, or I've walked by and I've heard the little, you know, naysayer say, you know, she got AIDS or something like that, you know. And I just walk with my head up, or I'll try to educate them as much as possible. If they just don't want to have anything to do with me or have the education, then, you know, that's one thing. But at this time in my life, you know, 23 years, my skin is pretty thick with that. So
Right.
That's
now,
to educate other people, for the people that are, that don't have that courage, you know, to educate people about the virus.
Now, what, you know, I mean, one thing I remember reading and hearing about and being told, of course, there's a difference between HIV and AIDS. What's the difference? Clarify that difference for us. You know, what is the difference? How does HIV become AIDS?
Well, actually, because HIV is a human immunodeficiency virus. It's a virus that attacks a human being's immune system. Every human being has an immune system, and the function of the immune system is to fight off germs, bacteria, and
right.
You know, things that don't belong in our body. So this HIV virus attacks itself to the DNA, and it eats away at that very immune system, that very thing that should be working to keep you healthy. CDC has a guideline, and they have a guideline that they go by and they count your white blood cells that boost up or make up your immune system. When that count, that level of those white blood cells, those T helper cells, get below 200, you have a weakened immune system, which allows opportunity for things to invade your body and make you sick. And those infections are called opportunistic infections. They take the opportunity to come in because you have a weakened immune system, not strong enough to fight them off. And some of them can be PCP, pneumonia, or different kind of skin cancers. And when you have two of those with a CD4 count below 200, then you're considered as having an AIDS diagnosis or advanced stage of AIDS.
Okay. So when your blood count is below, your white cell blood count is below 200, that's when they say that, okay, so you have a beyond weakened immune system. This is full-blown AIDS at this point.
Yeah, advanced stage of HIV, yeah. And, you know, because they try to keep it above as much as possible, above 200. Because the higher it is, actually, the stronger your immune system will fight for you.
Okay.
People without a compromised immune system, you know, your immune system is going to fight off a lot of germs, bacteria, infections, and diseases. But the weaker it is, the easier it is for those things to take the opportunity to come in your body and harm, you know, make you sick.
Yeah, yeah.
And then excuse me?
Go ahead.
No, and then I was just going to say they also look at what's called your viral load. So the viral load is, you know, the amount of virus that's active in your body, you know, and how fast that virus is producing itself. And so the goal there is to keep it undetectable, you know, or below 50 copies. So that you want to keep your viral load down really low, because that's the copies of the virus. And you want to keep your T cells, your CD4 count, up as high as possible.
Now, if you're just now tuning in, you're listening to Living and Dating with an STD, the female perspective on Broad Street Speaks Radio. I have Ruth Royster and Jennifer on the phone with me, sharing their experiences about living with HIV and herpes, respectively. Jennifer,
What was your mother's reaction when you shared this with her?
She cried. She was shocked because she had no idea. She had no idea I was active. Like, we're close. We're extremely close. But I just didn't share that with her out of respect. I was kind of afraid to come at her with the sex talk.
Yeah.
But yeah, she cried. She kind of had to walk out of the room for a little bit. She was with me.
Yeah. How, you know, what was the rest of your family's response to it, the ones that you that didn't find out and you talked to about it?
Well, they were disappointed in me because I've always been, like, I don't know, the good one, I guess, out of my siblings. I don't really know what to call it. But they were disappointed in me, and they just wished, like, I wasn't so young, and I guess they thought I was a little bit smarter than that.
Yeah.
But nobody asked me or anything.
Right. The funny thing about the whole smarter than that is, it goes back to what we were saying about education and, you know, being... You don't ever think it can happen to you. Was that a thought that ran through your head?
Oh, I never had that thought, ever, because I have fast friends, and I've seen and heard it all.
Right.
Okay, I've
right.
seen and heard it all. I got 16 pregnant friends running around everywhere. I know what can happen to me. I just slipped up one time, and I got my consequences.
And it only takes one time. But then the other thing, though, and then you get a you know, yeah, one thing that's really big, though, and sometimes it bothers me, you know, men living with these diseases, and one or two things tend to happen, you know, they're cheating on you, you know, being selfish and not letting you know that they're having multiple sex partners, or that they don't want to get tested, and you know, I sometimes just wonder if it bothers me that men take advantage of these like, types of situations. So, for instance, with you, not being that sexually active, and this could probably be that one of the many, like, few partners that you had sex with, and they know that. Like, you know, do you feel like he took advantage of that situation, knowing that, oh, she doesn't have anything, so we can have unprotected sex?
He definitely, especially my age. My age came in big, too. He would think that I'm not really, you know, doing too much, and that I guess that benefits
right.
him as a male. He was a lot older than me, a lot more experienced.
Mm.
I'm sure he was getting around. And I should have known
right.
better.
Right.
But, yeah,
right.
I'm pretty sure that was a big thing as in why he was comfortable not using protection.
And again, the thing is, they're always comfortable because they know on their end what they know and you don't know. And again, this is not even to bash males because I'm going to do a follow-up from the male perspective because I definitely think it's important to hear from men on why they don't like to get tested or why they fear getting tested or why they don't share their status with some of their partners, for those that don't share. Jennifer, how have you been dealing with this since then?
Well, I try not to think about it because that's just a default. That didn't change anything else about me. It's just a default. It matured me a lot more. Now I go into a relationship with precaution, and, like, if he's, you know, pressing me to have sex and I'm not ready to tell him that, I will leave the relationship alone. I want to wait till I'm ready and comfortable and he deserves for me to share this information with him so that we can go forward in our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, I'm just kind of focused on getting myself together and accepting it myself, speaking about it to myself, and then I'll move on to
right.
sharing it with others.
What judgments? Did you have any judgments and misperceptions, Jennifer, about the virus?
Judgments?
Or
no.
Even people living with it? Like, did anything cross your head? Like, oh my gosh! Like, you know, if you heard someone, like, if you heard one of your friends say, "Oh, they're living with herpes," like, did anything remotely just cross your mind? Like, you know what I mean? Like, just any type of judgments or misperceptions that you may have.
No. I don't see myself pointing at somebody and going, ha, ha. I don't think that's funny at all. And I wouldn't want that on myself, so I wouldn't wish it on anybody else. And if somebody else had it, I would accept them as a friend. I don't know if I would have sex with somebody who had the virus and I knew, unless I knew I was protected. But I wouldn't judge. I wasn't like, ugh, I'm disgusting now. Like, I didn't think of myself as nasty or anything. It's not like I ordered it on the internet. Like, it
right.
happened.
right. Ruth, what is the name of the organization that you work for, and what type of services do you all offer?
I work at an organization named Access AIDS Care. We offer case management, education, HIV rapid testing, transportation to and from doctor's appointments, support systems. So we offer a range of services that we provide for people that are infected as well as affected by HIV and AIDS. So if there's a family, we'll embrace that whole family and support mm-hmm. that whole family. Not just the infected person, but, that family.
Everyone around.
Yeah.
Because they are affected as well. That's so true. Are you currently dating, Ruth? Are you married to anyone, seeing anybody?
I'm actually engaged. Actually engaged to be married. My fiancé gave me a beautiful engagement ring this Christmas that just passed.
Well, congrats.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
How long have you all been engaged and moving forward with your situation? What was your fiancé's take on what you're living with and the rest of y'all lives together?
Well, my fiancé is very open. He's very passionate. He's actually a HIV educator as well, and he's very knowledgeable about HIV, so he's fine with it,
Does he have the virus as well or no?
Yeah, he does.
Okay. What message do you have for those, and this is for both of you all, this question's for both of you all, what message do you have for those having unprotected sex who think it can't happen to them, starting with you, Ruth?
I actually don't promote unprotected sex unless persons have that they know their status and a commitment from their partner. So I don't, know your status is very important because, and the only way that you can know your status is to be tested and, ask that person to let you see their test results because you can't get a copy of your test results anywhere that you get tested. And so, two negative test results because there's a window period. So you could test, and it takes anywhere from 3 to 6 months for an accurate HIV test to show up.
Mm.
So we definitely want to encourage people to know their status, ask their partner about their sexual history, learn as much as they can possibly learn about HIV and education, educate yourself. Because, things are always changing, so none of us know everything about HIV. We may learn something this year, and in 2 or 3 months it's changed. But we do know that how the virus is transmitted, and it's been like that for the last 30 years. So that's
right.
A fact. Those are facts.
So educate yourself, know your status, and don't have unprotected sex, basically. Right, Ruth?
Yeah, that's right. Protect yourself.
Protect yourself. What about
protect
you, Jennifer?
And get to know your partner as much as possible.
Yes. I agree. I totally agree.
But know you. First of all, know you, because sometimes we're so, busy jumping into sexual activity and, longing to be loved and wanting affection. And sometimes, that's a whole nother topic, but sometimes we don't even, get to know who we are or like ourselves. So sometimes we're using sex as a drug.
Because
that's just going to make us feel better by having somebody there to hug us, to tell us that they love us. And we may really know in our mind that they really don't even care nothing about us. And, that they have one goal in mind, but it's okay because that makes me feel better. Because if I'm being sexually active, at least I I can believe that, you know, somebody really cares about me. So get to know who you are.
I was, and then, you know, when you chimed in on a perfect point, I was going to say, you know, we as women are just so quick to put our health in the hands of a stranger, and no matter how comfortable we get, it's just kind of like, oh, you know, nothing's, that's fine. We don't even think about it. And because I think people don't like the process of, this is going to take too long. I think he's attractive, but I'm going to have sex with him. Opposed to, you know what, this, my health is my wealth, but I have to be careful with this. Jennifer, what about you? What would you say to some of your friends?
I agree with everything Ruth said, but I say just take your time. Like, get to know this person. You're trusting them. This is your body. This is what you're carrying around. This is your. You're the only person who has control over your body. Don't let somebody tell you, oh, I'm good, I'm good. No, use the protection. Know the person you're with. Go get tested. There's free clinics. There, you can take your friends, your family, whoever you're comfortable with, go get tested. Don't be embarrassed. This is what they see every day. They want to help you. Because I would be terrified to go by myself. Just think about it. Like, 2 seconds put on protection is worth not having a disease you deal with for the rest of your life. Over one little, you know, second of pleasure. It's not worth it. Just take care of you first. And if they're not willing to do that for you, they're just not. They don't deserve anything from you at all. They don't deserve anything from you.
There it is. I like that. Just run like that. Ruth, what would you say to your younger self, looking back?
Looking back, you know, wow. Being a person that I am now, first of all, I would have never gotten involved in drugs because, I never would have took a chance to experiment with drugs. And I definitely would take my time, you know, all the things that we've been talking about, I would have learned, I'd have learned to love me. And that's what I didn't do because I think when we care about ourselves, it's, you know, it shows. You just, some things you're not willing to do. I think that our values, you know, like I say, there are standards that I have now that I didn't have. I think I looked for affection. You know, I called it love, but I think I looked for affection in all the wrong places. And being in a, for me, it was being in a hurry to grow up.
Yeah.
Being in a hurry.
In a hurry to grow up. How often? Oh, my goodness. Your story is phenomenal because being so transparent and being so honest, a lot of people just need to hear this, to let go of what the media and society has filled our minds with. You know, I remember you saying earlier that, you know, at first this was a gay man's disease, like that's how they were portraying it. But these viruses know no race, know no color, gender, I mean, age. It does not matter. It does not matter. Jennifer, my last question is to you. What do you want to say? When you look back on the situation with the guy, would you have done anything differently, or do you regret that moment?
I'm sorry, are you talking to me?
Yes, Jennifer, yes, I'm talking to you.
Sorry, I missed your question. Can you repeat that, please?
Yeah, I would say, going back on when you slept with the guy, is there anything that you would have done differently, or do you regret that moment at all?
I don't regret anything because everything happens for a reason, but I definitely would have got to know him a little bit better. I was, like, rushing, and I don't know. I just had this feeling that, like, sex was something that had to happen when we were in that situation. Well, not just that day, because we had been active before, but I would have took my time and thought about, okay, he needs to put a condom on.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I would change. I would have asked him to put a condom on, and things probably would have went a lot differently.
Was he your first, or he wasn't your first?
He was my first, actually.
He was your first. And
So that makes it a lot. That's a little bit more difficult, you would think, right?
Yeah.
Because certain passionate
yeah.
that first. And I mean, I would have busted windows in his car with, you know, like Jasmine Sullivan's song, busting windows out your car. That would have been a lot to deal with at 16.
I have no idea, but it's the time frame that I had found out. We weren't really around each other. Like, we were talking. We spoke on the phone and everything. Like, he had even sent me a text message that next day before I could call him and talk to him, saying, oh, I want to come see you, blah, blah, blah. I went berserk. But he's lucky I was in class because he really would have got a piece of my mind. So we were talking through text message, and I was just like, just leave me alone. You already said you don't want to, you know. Like, I let him know what it was, and he was still talking to me. I'm just like, no, I'm not going to let this fly. So I didn't
yeah.
get to put my hands on anything that belonged to him, but I probably would have. That definitely would have happened.
That's good. That is good. That is so good.
He wouldn't have had anything.
And let me not promote that. Let me not promote that. But I mean, the point that I was making, that analogy was just to be that. Because you're, as a woman's first, like, that's your first. And you have all these feelings and you're attached to them. But for the first time you have sex and to contract something, it just kind of
Yeah,
you know, devastating. Exactly, devastating. That's what I think about. You know, Ruth, how can they contact your organization, keep in touch with you? I mean, you know, hire you for speaking engagements, whatever. How can they reach Mrs. Ruth Royster?
Okay, my email address is rroyster@accessaid.org.
Okay.
And
your
my
yep.
is spelled Aura as in for Ruth, and then Aura Royster at access access AIDS.org.
Okay. And did you have a phone number as well?
Yes, the phone number there is area code 757-625-6992. And you can just ask to speak with Ruth Royster. If I'm not in the office at the time, ask for my voicemail box and leave me a message, and I will return the call.
Okay, that's phenomenal. I have to say, ladies, thank you so much for joining me and being so open and transparent about your situation. You know, Jennifer, you are so brave and so
yes, she is.
Right, confident and
thank you.
I mean, you're doing it, girl. I don't really know what else to say. You're very strong and I definitely learned a lot from both of you ladies. And Ruth, this will not be the last time you hear from me. I went to school in the 757 area, so next time I'm in town, I'll make sure to call you and maybe we could do
please
lunch or something.
Please do. And thank you, and I applaud you for addressing this topic. Thank you very much. I think that when we stay silent, we can't help anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it hurts us as well. So thank you for opening, you know, the airways and addressing STDs. Thank you, Jennifer.
Yes. And I'll be reaching out to you all again too, because I want to get a man of color to talk about his situation as well, because I know it's always going to be two different views. So I want to make sure everyone hears that as well. But I'll make sure to post your information to your organization. And Jennifer, keep your head up, honey. You know, you got a lot of years ahead of you. And it's phenomenal, too, for you, Ruth, that they told you you have a life expectancy of 2 years, and you've been living for over 20, okay? So
yeah.
That is great. That is great. Ladies, you all have a great evening, and thank you again for joining me.
Thank you.
You as well.
Yeah.
Be blessed.
Okay. All right.
Good night.
You have a good night.
You have a good night as well. Good night. Bye-bye.
So I have to say, I'm just humbled and gracious for my guests, Ruth Royster and Jennifer, for being so transparent and honest about their situation. You know, our health is our wealth, and no matter how comfortable you get with your partner. Do not leave your house in their hands. There will be a part two this time from the male perspective. I think that's very important. You can catch this episode and other archive shows on brownskin.com, spelled B-R-N-S-K-N. And it's also podcasting on iTunes. Subscribe for free. You've been listening to the Black History Month series on Brown Skin Speaks Radio all this month. New episodes to come next week, but I will leave you with this question. Do you know your status, or are you in denial? Until next time, Brown Skin Speaks. Have a good night.